suffrage movement, like Rose Schneiderman of the garment workers. At a Cooper Union meeting in New York, she replied to a politician who said that women, given the vote, would lose their femininity. Women in the laundries stand for 13 or 14 hours in the terrible steam and heat with their hands in hot starch. Surely these women won't lose any more of their beauty and charm by putting a ballot in a ballot box once a year than they are likely to lose standing in foundries or laundries all year round. Every spring in New York, the parades for women's suffrage kept growing. In 1912, a news report. All along Fifth Avenue from Washington Square, where the parade formed, to 57th Street, where it disbanded, were gathered thousands of men and women of New York. They blocked every cross street on the line of march. Many were inclined to laugh and jeer, but none did. The sight of the impressive column of women striding five abreast up the middle of the street stifled all thought of ridicule. Women doctors, women lawyers, women architects, women artists, actresses, sculptors, women waitresses, domestics, a huge division of industrial workers, all marched with an intensity and purpose that astonished the crowds that lined the streets. From Washington in the spring of 1913 came a New York Times report. In a woman's suffrage demonstration today, the Capitol saw the greatest parade of women in its history. In the parade, over 5,000 women passed down Pennsylvania Avenue. It was an astonishing demonstration. It was estimated that 500,000 persons watched the women march for their cause. Some women radicals were skeptical. Emma Goldman, the anarchist and feminist, spoke her mind forcefully, as always, on the subject of women's suffrage. "Our modern fetish is universal suffrage. The women of Australia and New Zealand can vote and help make the laws. Are the labor conditions better there? The history of the political activities of man proves that they have given him absolutely nothing that he could not have achieved in a more direct, less costly, and more lasting manner. As a matter of fact, every inch of ground he has gained has been through a constant fight, a ceaseless struggle, for self-assertion and not through suffrage. There is no reason whatever to assume that woman, in her climb to emancipation, has been or will be helped by the ballot. Her development, her freedom, her independence must come from and through herself, first, by asserting herself as a personality, second, by refusing the right to anyone over her body, by refusing to bear children unless she wants them, by refusing to be a servant to God, the state, society, the husband, the family, etc., by making her life simpler, but deeper and richer. Only that, and not the ballot, will set woman free." And Helen Keller, writing in 1911 to a suffragist in England, "Our democracy is but a name. We vote? What does that mean? It means that we choose between two bodies of real, though not avowed, autocrats. We choose between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. You ask for votes for women. What good can votes do when 10/11 of the land of Great Britain belongs to 200,000 and only 1/11 to the rest of the 40 million? Have your men with their millions of votes freed themselves from this injustice?" Emma Goldman was not postponing the changing of woman's condition to some future socialist era. She wanted action more direct, more immediate than the vote. Helen Keller, while not an anarchist, also believed in continuous struggle outside the ballot box. Blind, deaf, she fought with her spirit, her pen. When she became active and openly socialist, the Brooklyn Eagle, which had previously treated her as a heroine, wrote that her mistakes spring out of the manifest limitations of her development. Her response was not accepted by the Eagle, but printed in the New York Call. She wrote that when once she met the editor of the Brooklyn Eagle, he complimented her lavishly. But now that I have come out for socialism, he reminds me and the public that I am blind and deaf and especially liable to error. She added, "Oh, ridiculous Brooklyn Eagle, what an ungallant bird it is, socially blind and deaf. It defends an intolerable system, a system that is the cause of much of the physical blindness and deafness which we are trying to prevent. The Eagle and I are at war. I hate the system which it represents. When it fights back, let it fight fair. It is not fair fighting or good argument to remind me and others that I cannot see or hear. I can read. I can read all the socialist books I have time for, in English, German, and French. If the editor of the Brooklyn Eagle should read some of them, he might be a wiser man and make a better newspaper. If I ever contribute to the socialist movement the book that I sometimes dream of, I know what I shall name it. Industrial Blindness and Social Deafness." Mother Jones did not seem especially interested in the feminist movement. She was busy organizing textile workers and miners and organizing their wives and children. One of her many feats was the organization of a children's march to Washington to demand the end of child labor. As the 20th century opened, 284,000 children between the ages of 10 and 15 worked in mines, mills, factories. She described this. "In the spring of 1903, I went to Kensington, Pennsylvania, where 75,000 textile workers were on strike. Of this number, at least 10,000 were little children. The workers were striking for more pay and shorter hours. Every day, little children came into union headquarters, some with their hands off, some with the thumb missing, some with their fingers off at the knuckle. They were stooped little things, round-shouldered and skinny. I asked some of the parents if they would let me have their little boys and girls for a week or 10 days, promising to bring them back safe and sound. A man named Sweeney was marshal. A few men and women went with me. The children carried knapsacks on their backs, in which was a knife and fork, a tin cup and plate. One little fellow had a drum, and another had a fife. We carried banners that said, 'We want time to play.' The children marched through New Jersey and New York, and down to Oyster Bay, to try to see President Theodore Roosevelt, but he refused to see them. But our march had done its work. We had drawn the attention of the nation to the crime of child labor." That same year, children working 60 hours a week in textile mills in Philadelphia went on strike, carrying signs, "We want to go to school, 55 hours or nothing." One gets a sense of the energy and fire of some of those turn-of-the-century radicals by looking at the police record of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. 1906-16, organizer, lecturer for IWW. 1918-24, organizer, Workers' Defense Union. Arrested in New York, 1906, free speech case, dismissed. Active in Spokane, Washington, free speech fight, 1909. Arrested, Missoula, Montana, 1909, in free speech fight of IWW. Spokane, Washington, free speech fight of IWW, hundreds arrested. In Philadelphia, arrested 3 times, 1911, at strike meetings of Baldwin Locomotive Works. Active in Lawrence Textile Strike, 1912. Hotel Workers Strike, 1912. New York Patterson Textile Strike, 1913. Defense Work for Eder Giovannitti Case, 1912. Mesaba Range Strike, Minnesota, 1916. Everett IWW Case, Spokane, Washington, 1916. Joe Hill Defense, 1914. Arrested, Duluth, Minnesota, 1917, charged with vagrancy under law passed to stop IWW and pacifist speakers, case dismissed. Indicted in Chicago IWW Case, 1917. Black women faced double oppression. A Negro nurse wrote to a newspaper in 1912, "We poor colored women, wage earners in the South, are fighting a terrible battle. On the one hand, we are assailed by black men who should be our natural protectors, and whether in the cook kitchen, at the washtub, over the sewing machine, behind the baby carriage, or at the ironing board, we are but little more than pack horses, beasts of burden, slaves. In this early part of the 20th century, labeled by generations of white scholars as the progressive period, lynchings were reported every week. It was the low point for Negroes, North and South, the nadir, as Ryford Logan, a black historian, put it. In 1910, there were 10 million Negroes in the United States, and 9 million of them were in the South. The government of the United States, between 1901 and 1921, the presidents were Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, whether Republican or Democrat, watched Negroes being lynched, observed murderous riots against blacks in Statesboro, Georgia, Brownsville, Texas, and Atlanta, Georgia, and did nothing. There were Negroes in the Socialist Party, but the Socialist Party did not go much out of its way to act on the race question. As Ray Ginger writes of Debs, when race prejudice was thrust at Debs, he always publicly repudiated it. He always insisted on absolute equality, but he failed to accept the view that special measures were sometimes needed to achieve this equality. Blacks began to organize a National Afro-American Council, formed in 1903, to protest against lynching, peonage, discrimination, disenfranchisement. The National Association of Colored Women, formed around the same time, condemned segregation and lynchings. In Georgia in 1906, there was an Equal Rights Convention which pointed to 260 Georgia Negroes lynched since 1885. It asked the right to vote, the right to enter the militia, to be on juries. It agreed blacks should work hard, and at the same time we must agitate, complain, protest, and keep protesting against the invasion of our manhood rights. W.E.B. Du Bois, teaching in Atlanta, Georgia in 1905, sent out a letter to Negro leaders throughout the country, calling them to a conference just across the Canadian border from Buffalo, near Niagara Falls. It was the start of the Niagara Movement. Du Bois, born in Massachusetts, the first black to receive a Ph.D. from Harvard University in 1895, had just written and published his poetic, powerful book, The Souls of Black Folk. Du Bois was a socialist sympathizer, although only briefly a party member. One of his associates in calling the Niagara meeting was William Monroe Trotter, a young black man in Boston of militant views, who edited a weekly newspaper, The Guardian. In it, he attacked the moderate ideas of Booker T. Washington. When in the summer of 1903, Washington spoke to an audience of 2,000 at Boston Church, Trotter and his supporters prepared 9 provocative questions which caused a commotion and led to fistfights. Trotter and a friend were arrested. This may have added to the spirit of indignation which led Du Bois to spearhead the Niagara meeting. The tone of the Niagara group was strong. "We refuse to allow the impression to remain that the Negro-American assents to inferiority, is submissive under oppression, and apologetic before insults. Through helplessness we may submit, but the voice of protest of 10 million Americans must never cease to assail the ears of their fellows so long as America is unjust." A race riot in Springfield, Illinois, prompted the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in 1910. Whites dominated the leadership of the new organization. Du Bois was the only black officer. He was also the first editor of the NAACP periodical, The Crisis. The NAACP concentrated on legal action and education, but Du Bois represented in it that spirit which was embodied in the Niagara Movement's declaration. Persistent, manly agitation is the way to liberty. What was clear in this period to blacks, to feminists, to labor organizers and socialists, was that they could not count on the national government. True, this was the progressive period, the start of the age of reform. But it was a reluctant reform, aimed at quieting the popular risings, not making fundamental changes. What gave it the name progressive was that new laws were passed. Under Theodore Roosevelt, there was the Meat Inspection Act, the Hepburn Act to regulate railroads and pipelines, a Pure Food and Drug Act. Under Taft, the Mann-Elkins Act put telephone and telegraph systems under the regulation of the Interstate Commerce Commission. In Woodrow Wilson's presidency, the Federal Trade Commission was introduced to control the growth of monopolies, and the Federal Reserve Act to regulate the country's money and banking system. Under Taft were proposed the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, allowing a graduated income tax, and the 17th Amendment, providing for the election of senators directly by a popular vote instead of by the state legislatures as the original Constitution provided. Also at this time, a number of states passed laws regulating wages and hours, providing for safety inspection of factories and compensation for injured workmen. It was a time of public investigations aimed at soothing protest. In 1913, the Pujo Committee of Congress studied the concentration of power in the banking industry, and the Commission on Industrial Relations of the Senate held hearings on labor management conflict. Undoubtedly, ordinary people benefited to some extent from these changes. The system was rich, productive, complex. It could give enough of a share of its riches to enough of the working class to create a protective shield between the bottom and the top of society. A study of immigrants in New York between 1905 and 1915 finds that 32% of Italians and Jews rose out of the manual class to higher levels, although not to much higher levels. But it was also true that many Italian immigrants did not find the opportunities inviting enough for them to stay. In one four-year period, 73 Italians left New York for every 100 that arrived. Still, enough Italians became construction workers, enough Jews became businessmen and professionals to create a middle-class cushion for class conflict. Fundamental conditions did not change, however, for the vast majority of tenant farmers, factory workers, slum dwellers, miners, farm laborers, working men and women, black and white. Robert Wiebe sees in the progressive movement an attempt by the system to adjust to changing conditions in order to achieve more stability. Through rules with impersonal sanctions, it sought continuity and predictability in a world of endless change. It assigned far greater power to government, and it encouraged the centralization of authority. Harold Faulkner concluded that this new emphasis on strong government was for the benefit of the most powerful economic groups. Gabriel Kolko calls it the emergence of political capitalism, where the businessmen took firmer control of the political system because the private economy was not efficient enough to forestall protest from below. The businessmen, Kolko says, were not opposed to the new reforms. They initiated them, pushed them, to stabilize the capitalist system in a time of uncertainty and trouble. For instance, Theodore Roosevelt made a reputation for himself as a trust buster, although his successor, Taft, a conservative, while Roosevelt was a progressive, launched more antitrust suits than did Roosevelt. In fact, as Wiebe points out, two of J.P. Morgan's men, Elbert Gary, chairman of U.S. Steel, and George Perkins, who would later become a campaigner for Roosevelt, arranged a general understanding with Roosevelt by which they would cooperate in any investigation by the Bureau of Corporations in return for a guarantee of their company's legality. They would do this through private negotiations with the president. A gentleman's agreement between reasonable people, Wiebe says with a bit of sarcasm. The panic of 1907, as well as the growing strength of the socialists, wobblies, and trade unions, speeded the process of reform. According to Wiebe, around 1908, a qualitative shift in outlook occurred among large numbers of these men of authority. The emphasis was now on enticements and compromises. It continued with Wilson, and a great many reform-minded citizens indulged the illusion of a progressive fulfillment. What radical critics now say of those reforms was said at the time, 1901, by the Banker's magazine. As the business of the country has learned the secret of combination, it is gradually subverting the power of the politician and rendering him subservient to its purposes. There was much to stabilize, much to protect. By 1904, 318 trusts, with capital of more than $7 billion, controlled 40% of the U.S. manufacturing. In 1909, a manifesto of the new progressivism appeared, a book called The Promise of American Life by Herbert Croly, editor of The New Republic and an admirer of Theodore Roosevelt. He saw the need for discipline and regulation if the American system were to continue. Government should do more, he said, and he hoped to see the sincere and enthusiastic imitation of heroes and saints, by whom he may have meant Theodore Roosevelt. Richard Hofstadter, in his biting chapter on the man the public saw as the great lover of nature and physical fitness, the war hero, the Boy Scout in the White House, says, "The advisers to whom Roosevelt listened were almost exclusively representatives of industrial and finance capital, men like Hanna, Robert Bacon, and George W. Perkins of the House of Morgan, Elihu Root, Senator Nelson W. Aldrich, and James Stillman of the Rockefeller interests." Responding to his worried brother-in-law writing from Wall Street, Roosevelt replied, "I intend to be most conservative, but in the interests of the corporations themselves, and above all, in the interests of the country." Roosevelt supported the regulatory Hepburn Act because he feared something worse. He wrote to Henry Cabot Lodge that the railroad lobbyists who opposed the bill were wrong. "I think they are very short-sighted not to understand that to beat it means to increase the movement for government ownership of the railroads." His action against the trusts was to induce them to accept government regulation in order to prevent destruction. He prosecuted the Morgan Railroad monopoly in the Northern Securities case, considering it an antitrust victory, but it hardly changed anything, and although the Sherman Act provided for criminal penalties, there was no prosecution of the men who had planned the monopoly, Morgan, Harriman, Hill. As for Woodrow Wilson, Hofstadter points out he was a conservative from the start. As a historian and political scientist, Wilson wrote, The State, "In politics, nothing radically novel may safely be attempted." He urged slow and gradual change. His attitude toward labor, Hofstadter says, was generally hostile, and he spoke of the crude and ignorant minds of the populists. James Weinstein, the corporate ideal in the liberal state, has studied the reforms of the progressive period, especially the process by which business and government, sometimes with the aid of labor leaders, worked out the legislative changes they thought necessary. Weinstein sees a conscious and successful effort to guide and control the economic and social policies of federal, state, and municipal governments by various business groupings in their own long-range interest. While the original impetus for reform came from protesters and radicals, in the current century, particularly on the federal level, few reforms were enacted without the tacit approval, if not the guidance, of the large corporate interests. These interests assembled liberal reformers and intellectuals to aid them in such matters. Weinstein's definition of liberalism as a means of stabilizing the system in the interests of big business is different from that of the liberals themselves. Arthur Schlesinger writes, "Liberalism in America has been ordinarily the movement on the part of the other sections of society to restrain the power of the business community." If Schlesinger is describing the hope or intent of these other sections, he may be right. If he is describing the actual effect of these liberal reforms, that restraint has not happened. The controls were constructed skillfully. In 1900, a man named Ralph Easley, a Republican and conservative, a schoolteacher and journalist, organized the National Civic Federation. Its aim was to get better relations between capital and labor. Its officers were mostly big businessmen and important national politicians, But its first vice president for a long time was Samuel Gompers of the AFL. Not all big businesses liked what the National Civic Federation was doing. Easily called these critics anarchists, opposed to the rational organization of the system. In fact, Easley wrote, our enemies are the socialists among the labor people and the anarchists among the capitalists. The NCF wanted a more sophisticated approach to trade unions, seeing them as an inevitable reality, therefore wanting to come to agreements with them rather than fight with them. Better to deal with a conservative union than face a militant one. After the Lawrence textile strike of 1912, John Golden, head of the conservative AFL textile union workers, wrote Easley that the strike had given manufacturers a very rapid education, and some of them are falling all over themselves now to do business with our organization. The National Civic Federation did not represent all opinions in the business world. The National Association of Manufacturers didn't want to recognize organized labor in any way. Many businessmen did not want even the puny reforms proposed by the Civic Federation. But the Federation's approach represented the sophistication and authority of the modern state, determined to do what was best for the capitalist class as a whole, even if this irritated some capitalists. The new approach was concerned with the long-range stability of the system, even at the cost, sometimes, of short-term profits. Thus, the Federation drew up a model workman's compensation bill in 1910, and the following year, 12 states passed laws for compensation or accident insurance. When the Supreme Court said that year that the New York workman's compensation law was unconstitutional because it deprived corporations of property without due process of law, Theodore Roosevelt was angry. Such decisions, he said, added immensely to the strength of the Socialist Party. By 1920, 42 states had workman's compensation laws. As Weinstein says, it represented a growing maturity and sophistication on the part of many large corporation leaders who had come to understand, as Theodore Roosevelt often told them, that social reform was truly conservative. As for the Federal Trade Commission established by Congress in 1914, presumably to regulate trusts, a leader of the Civic Federation reported after several years of experience with it that it has apparently been carrying on its work with the purpose of securing the confidence of well-intentioned businessmen, members of the great corporations, as well as others. In this period, cities also put through reforms, many of them giving power to city councils instead of mayors, or hiring city managers. The idea was more efficiency, more stability. The end result of the movements was to place city government firmly in the hands of the business class, Weinstein says. What reformers saw as more democracy in city government, urban historian Samuel Hayes sees as the centralization of power in fewer hands, giving business and professional men more direct control over city government. The progressive movement, whether led by honest reformers like Senator Robert La Follette of Wisconsin, or disguised conservatives like Roosevelt, who was the Progressive Party candidate for president in 1912, seemed to understand it was fending off socialism. The Milwaukee Journal, a progressive organ, said the conservatives fight socialism blindly, while the progressives fight it intelligently and seek to remedy the abuses and conditions upon which it thrives. Frank Munsey, a director of U.S. Steel, writing to Roosevelt, seeing him as the best candidate for 1912, confided in him that the United States must move toward a more parental guardianship of the people, who needed the sustaining and guiding hand of the state. It was the work of the state to think for the people and plan for the people, the steel executive said. It seems quite clear that much of this intense activity for progressive reform was intended to head off socialism. Easley talked of The menace of socialism as evidenced by its growth in the colleges, churches, newspapers. In 1910, Victor Berger became the first member of the Socialist Party elected to Congress. In 1911, 73 socialist mayors were elected, and 1,200 lesser officials in 340 cities and towns. The press spoke of the rising tide of socialism. A privately circulated memorandum suggested to one of the departments of the National Civic Federation, in view of the rapid spread in the United States of socialistic doctrines, what was needed was a carefully planned and wisely directed effort to instruct public opinion as to the real meaning of socialism. The memorandum suggested that the campaign must be very skillfully and tactfully carried out, that it should not violently attack socialism and anarchism as such, but should be patient and persuasive, and defend three ideas: individual liberty, private property, and inviolability of contract. It is hard to say how many socialists saw clearly how useful reform was to capitalism. But in 1912, a left-wing socialist from Connecticut, Robert Lamont, wrote, "Old age pensions and insurance against sickness, accident, and unemployment are cheaper, are better business than jails, poorhouses, asylums, hospitals." He suggested that progressives would work for reforms, but socialists must make only impossible demands which would reveal the limitations of the reformers. Did the progressive reforms succeed in doing what they intended? Stabilize the capitalist system by repairing its worst defects, blunt the edge of the socialist movement, restore some measure of class peace in a time of increasingly bitter clashes between capital and labor? To some extent, perhaps. But the Socialist Party continued to grow. The IWW continued to agitate. And shortly after Woodrow Wilson took office, there began in Colorado one of the most bitter and violent struggles between workers and corporate capital in the history of the country. This was the Colorado coal strike that began in September 1913 and culminated in the Ludlow Massacre of April 1914. 11,000 miners in southern Colorado, mostly foreign-born, Greeks, Italians, Serbs, worked for the Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation, which was owned by the Rockefeller family. Aroused by the murder of one of their organizers, they went on strike against low pay, dangerous conditions, and feudal domination of their lives in towns completely controlled by the mining companies. Mother Jones, at this time an organizer for the United Mine Workers, came into the area, fired up the miners with her oratory, and helped them in those critical first months of the strike until she was arrested, kept in a dungeon-like cell, and then forcibly expelled from the state. When the strike began, the miners were immediately evicted from their shacks in the mining towns. Aided by the United Mine Workers Union, they set up tents in the nearby hills and carried on the strike, the picketing, from these tent colonies. The gunmen hired by the Rockefeller interests, the Baldwin-Felts Detective Agency, using Gatling guns and rifles, raided the tent colonies. The death list of miners grew, but they hung on, drove back an armored train in a gun battle, fought to keep out strikebreakers. With the miners resisting, refusing to give in, the mines not able to operate, the Colorado governor, referred to by a Rockefeller mine manager as "our little cowboy governor," called out the National Guard, with the Rockefeller supplying the guard's wages. The miners at first thought the guard was sent to protect them and greeted its arrivals with flags and cheers. They soon found out the guard was there to destroy the strike. The guard brought strikebreakers in under cover of night, not telling them there was a strike. Guardsmen beat miners, arrested them by the hundreds, rode down with their horses parades of women in the streets of Trinidad, the central town in the area. And still the miners refused to give in. When they lasted through the cold winter of 1913 to 1914, it became clear that extraordinary measures would be needed to break the strike. In April 1914, two National Guard companies were stationed in the hills overlooking the largest tent colony of strikers, the one at Ludlow, housing 1,000 men, women, and children. On the morning of April 20th, a machine gun attack began on the tents. The miners fired back. Their leader, a Greek named Loutikas, was lured up into the hills to discuss a truce, then shot to death by a company of National Guardsmen. The women and children dug pits beneath the tents to escape the gunfire. At dusk, the guard moved down from the hills with torches, set fire to the tents, and the families fled into the hills. 13 people were killed by gunfire. The following day, a telephone linesman going through the ruins of the Ludlow tent colony lifted an iron cot covering a pit in one of the tents and found the charred, twisted bodies of 11 children and 2 women. This became known as the Ludlow Massacre. The news spread quickly over the country. In Denver, the United Mine Workers issued a call to arms. "Gather together for defensive purposes all arms and ammunition legally available." 300 armed strikers marched from other tent colonies into the Ludlow area, cut telephone and telegraph wires, and prepared for battle. Railroad workers refused to take soldiers from Trinidad to Ludlow. At Colorado Springs, 300 Union miners walked off their jobs and headed for the Trinidad district, carrying revolvers, rifles, shotguns. In Trinidad itself, miners attended a funeral service for the 26 dead at Ludlow, then walked from the funeral to a nearby building where arms were stacked for them. They picked up rifles and moved into the hills, destroying mines, killing mine guards, exploding mine shafts. The press reported that the hills in every direction seemed suddenly to be alive with men. In Denver, 82 soldiers and a company on a troop train headed for Trinidad refused to go. The press reported, "The men declared they would not engage in the shooting of women and children. They hissed the 350 men who did start and shouted imprecations at them." 5,000 people demonstrated in the rain on the lawn in front of the state capitol at Denver, asking that the National Guard officers at Ludlow be tried for murder, denouncing the governor as an accessory. The Denver Cigar Makers Union voted to send 500 armed men to Ludlow and Trinidad. Women in the United Garment Workers Union in Denver announced 400 of their members had volunteered as nurses to help the strikers. All over the country there were meetings, demonstrations. Pickets marched in front of the Rockefeller office at 26 Broadway, New York City. A minister protested in front of the church where Rockefeller sometimes gave sermons and was clubbed by the police. The New York Times carried an editorial on the events in Colorado, which were now attracting international attention. The Times' emphasis was not on the atrocity that had occurred, but on the mistake in tactics that had been made. Its editorial on the Ludlow Massacre began, "Somebody blundered. 2 days later, with the miners armed and in the hills of the mine district," the Times wrote, "with the deadliest weapons of civilization in the hands of savage-minded men, there can be no telling to what lengths the war in Colorado will go unless it is quelled by force. The president should turn his attention from Mexico long enough to take stern measures in Colorado." The governor of Colorado asked for federal troops to restore order, and Woodrow Wilson complied. This accomplished, the strike petered out. Congressional committees came in and took thousands of pages of testimony. The union had not won recognition. 66 men, women, and children had been killed. Not one militiaman or mine guard had been indicted for crime. Still, Colorado had been a scene of ferocious class conflict, whose emotional repercussions had rolled through the entire country. The threat of class rebellion was clearly still there in the industrial conditions of the United States. In the undeterred spirit of rebellion among working people, whatever legislation had been passed, whatever liberal reforms were on the books, whatever investigations were undertaken and words of regret and conciliation uttered. The Times had referred to Mexico. On the morning that the bodies were discovered in the tent pit at Ludlow, American warships were attacking Veracruz, a city on the coast of Mexico, bombarding it, occupying it, leaving 100 Mexicans dead, because Mexico had arrested American sailors and refused to apologize to the United States with a 21-gun salute. Could patriotic fervor and the military spirit cover up class struggle? Unemployment, hard times, were growing in 1914. Could guns divert attention and create some national consensus against an external enemy? It surely was a coincidence, the bombardment of Veracruz, the attack on the Ludlow colony. Or perhaps it was, as someone once described human history, the natural selection of accidents. Perhaps the affair in Mexico was an instinctual response of the system for its own survival, to create a unity of fighting purpose among a people torn by internal conflict. The bombardment of Veracruz was a small incident, but in 4 months, the First World War would begin in Europe. Chapter 14. War is the health of the state. War is the health of the state, the radical writer Randolph Bourne said in the midst of the First World War. Indeed, as the nations of Europe went to war in 1914, the governments flourished, patriotism bloomed, class struggle was stilled, and young men died in frightful numbers on the battlefields, often for 100 yards of land, a line of trenches. In the United States, not yet in the war, there was worry about the health of the state. Socialism was growing. The IWW seemed to be everywhere. Class conflict was intense. In the summer of 1916, during a Preparedness Day parade in San Francisco, a bomb exploded, killing 9 people. 2 local radicals, Tom Mooney and Warren Billings, were arrested and would spend 20 years in prison. Shortly after that, Senator James Wadsworth of New York suggested compulsory military training for all males to avert the danger that these people of ours shall be divided into classes. Rather, we must let our young men know that they owe some responsibility to this country. The supreme fulfillment of that responsibility was taking place in Europe. 10 million were to die on the battlefield. 20 million were to die of hunger and disease related to the war. And no one since that day has been able to show that the war brought any gain for humanity that would be worth 1 human life. The rhetoric of the socialists that it was an imperialist war now seems moderate and hardly arguable. The advanced capitalist countries of Europe were fighting over boundaries, colonies, spheres of influence. They were competing for Alsace-Lorraine, the Balkans, Africa, the Middle East. The war came shortly after the opening of the 20th century, in the midst of exultation, perhaps only among the elite in the Western world, about progress and modernization. One day after the English declared war, Henry James wrote to a friend, "The plunge of civilization into this abyss of blood and darkness is a thing that so gives away the whole long age during which we have supposed the world to be gradually bettering." In the First Battle of the Marne, the British and French succeeded in blocking the German advance on Paris. Each side had 500,000 casualties. The killing started very fast and on a large scale. In August 1914, a volunteer for the British Army had to be 5 feet 8 inches to enlist. By October, the requirement was lowered to 5 feet 5 inches. That month, there were 30,000 casualties, and then one could be 5'3". In the first 3 months of the war, almost the entire original British army was wiped out. For 3 years, the battle lines remained virtually stationary in France. Each side would push forward, then back, then forward again, for a few yards, a few miles, while the corpses piled up. In 1916, the Germans tried to break through at Verdun. The British and French counterattacked along the Seine, moved forward a few miles, and lost 600,000 men. One day, the 9th Battalion of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry launched an attack with 800 men. 24 hours later, there were 84 left. Back home, the British were not told of the slaughter. One English writer recalled, "The most bloody defeat in the history of Britain might occur, and our press come out as bland and copious and graphic with nothing to show that we had not had quite a good day, a victory, really." The same thing was happening on the German side. As Erich Maria Remarque wrote in his great novel, on days when men by the thousands were being blown apart by machine guns and shells, the official dispatches announced, "All quiet on the Western Front." In July 1916, British General Douglas Haig ordered 11 divisions of English soldiers to climb out of their trenches and move toward the German lines. The 6 German divisions opened up with their machine guns. Of the 110,000 who attacked, 20,000 were killed, 40,000 more wounded. All those bodies strewn on no man's land, the ghostly territory between the contending trenches. On January 1, 1917, Haig was promoted to field marshal. What happened that summer is described tersely in William Langer's An Encyclopedia of World History. Despite the opposition of Lloyd George and the skepticism of some of his subordinates, Haig proceeded hopefully to the main offensive. The Third Battle of Ypres was a series of 8 heavy attacks, carried through in driving rain and fought over ground waterlogged and muddy. No breakthrough was effected, and the total gain was about 5 miles of territory, which made the Ypres salient more inconvenient than ever and cost the British about 400,000 men. The people of France and Britain were not told the extent of the casualties. When in the last year of the war, the Germans attacked ferociously on the Somme and left 300,000 British soldiers dead or wounded, London newspapers printed the following, we learn from Paul Fussell's The Great War in Modern Memory. "What can I do? How the civilian may help in this crisis? Be cheerful. Write encouragingly to friends at the front. Don't repeat foolish gossip. Don't listen to idle rumors. Don't think you know better than The Hague." Into this pit of death and deception came the United States in the spring of 1917. Mutinies were beginning to occur in the French army. Soon, out of 112 divisions, 68 would have mutinies. 629 men would be tried and condemned, 50 shot by firing squads. American troops were badly needed. President Woodrow Wilson had promised that the United States would stay neutral in the war. "There is such a thing as a nation being too proud to fight." But in April of 1917, the Germans had announced they would have their submarines sink any ship bringing supplies to their enemies, and they had sunk a number of merchant vessels. Wilson now said he must stand by the right of Americans to travel on merchant ships in the war zone. "I cannot consent to any abridgment of the rights of American citizens in any respect." As Richard Hofstadter points out, the American political tradition, this was rationalization of the flimsiest sort. The British had also been intruding on the rights of American citizens on the high seas, but Wilson was not suggesting we go to war with them. Hofstadter says Wilson was forced to find legal reasons for policies that were based not upon law, but upon the balance of power and economic necessities. It was unrealistic to expect that the Germans should treat the United States as neutral in the war, when the U.S. had been shipping great amounts of war materials to Germany's enemies. In early 1915, the British liner Lusitania was torpedoed and sunk by a German submarine. She sank in 18 minutes, and 1,198 people died, including 124 Americans. The United States claimed the Lusitania carried an innocent cargo, and therefore the torpedoing was a monstrous German atrocity. Actually, the Lusitania was heavily armed. It carried 1,248 cases of 3-inch shells, 4,927 boxes of cartridges, 1,000 rounds in each box, and 2,000 more cases of small arms ammunition. Her manifests were falsified to hide this fact, and the British and American governments lied about the cargo. Hofstadter wrote of economic necessities behind Wilson's war policy. In 1914, a serious recession had begun in the United States. J.P. Morgan later testified, "The war opened during a period of hard times. Business throughout the country was depressed. Farm prices were deflated. Unemployment was serious. The heavy industries were working far below capacity, and bank clearings were off." But by 1915, war orders for the Allies, mostly England, had stimulated the economy, and by April 1917, more than $2 billion worth of goods had been sold to the Allies. As Hofstadter says, "America became bound up with the Allies in a fateful union of war and prosperity." Prosperity depended much on foreign markets. It was believed by the leaders of the country. In 1897, the private foreign investments of the United States amounted to $700 million. By 1914, they were $3.5 billion. Wilson's Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, while a believer in neutrality in the war, also believed that the United States needed overseas markets. In May of 1914, he praised the president as one who had opened the doors of the weaker countries to an invasion of American capital and American enterprise. Back in 1907, Woodrow Wilson had said in a lecture at Columbia University, "Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. The doors of the nations which are closed must be battered down." In his 1912 campaign, he said, "Our domestic markets no longer suffice. We need foreign markets." In a memo to Bryan, he described his aim as an open door to the world. And in 1914, he said he supported the righteous conquest of foreign markets. With World War I, England became more and more a market for American goods and for loans at interest. J.P. Morgan and Company acted as agents for the Allies, and when in 1915 Wilson lifted the ban on private bank loans to the Allies, Morgan could now begin lending money in such great amounts as to both make great profit and tie American finance closely to the interest of a British victory in the war against Germany. The industrialists and the political leaders talked of prosperity as if it were classless, as if everyone gained from Morgan's loans. True, the war meant more production, more employment. But did the workers in the steel plants gain as much as U.S. Steel, which made $348 million in profit in 1916 alone? When the United States entered the war, it was the rich who took even more direct charge of the economy. Financier Bernard Baruch headed the War Industries Board, the most powerful of the wartime government agencies. Bankers, railroad men, and industrialists dominated these agencies. A remarkably perceptive article on the nature of the First World War appeared in May 1915 in the Atlantic Monthly. Written by W.E.B. Du Bois, it was titled, "The African Roots of War." It was a war for empire, of which the struggle between Germany and the Allies over Africa was both symbol and reality. In a very real sense, Africa is a prime cause of this terrible overturning of civilization, which we have lived to see. Africa, Du Bois said, is the land of the 20th century, because of the gold and diamonds of South Africa, the cocoa of Angola and Nigeria, the rubber and ivory of the Congo, the palm oil of the West Coast. Du Bois saw more than that. He was writing several years before Lenin's imperialism, which noted the new possibility of giving the working class of the imperial country a share of the loot. He pointed to the paradox of greater democracy in America alongside increased aristocracy and hatred toward darker races. He explained the paradox by the fact that the white working man has been asked to share the spoil of exploiting chinks and niggers. Yes, the average citizen of England, France, Germany, the United States had a higher standard of living than before. But whence comes this new wealth? It comes primarily from the darker nations of the world, Asia and Africa, South and Central America, the West Indies and the islands of the South Seas. Du Bois saw the ingenuity of capitalism in uniting exploiter and exploited, creating a safety valve for explosive class conflict. It is no longer simply the merchant prince or the aristocratic monopoly or even the employing class that is exploiting the world. It is the nation, a new democratic nation composed of united capital and labor. The United States fitted that idea of Du Bois. American capitalism needed international rivalry and periodic war to create an artificial community of interest between rich and poor, supplanting the genuine community of interest among the poor that showed itself in sporadic movements. How conscious of this were individual entrepreneurs and statesmen? That is hard to know. But their actions, even if half-conscious, instinctive drives to survive, matched such a scheme. And in 1917, this demanded a national consensus for war. The government quickly succeeded in creating such a consensus, according to traditional histories. Woodrow Wilson's biographer Arthur Link wrote, "In the final analysis, American policy was determined by the president and public opinion." In fact, there is no way of measuring public opinion at that time, and there is no persuasive evidence that the public wanted war. The government had to work hard to create its consensus. That there was no spontaneous urge to fight is suggested by the strong measures taken, a draft of young men, an elaborate propaganda campaign throughout the country, and harsh punishment for those who refused to get in line. Despite the rousing words of Wilson about a war, to end all wars, and to make the world safe for democracy, Americans did not rush to enlist. 1 million men were needed, but in the first 6 weeks after the declaration of war, only 73,000 volunteered. Congress voted overwhelmingly for a draft. George Creel, a veteran newspaperman, became the government's official propagandist for the war. He set up a committee on public information to persuade Americans the war was right. It sponsored 75,000 speakers who gave 750,000 4-minute speeches in 5,000 American cities and towns. It was a massive effort to excite a reluctant public. At the beginning of 1917, a member of the National Civic Federation had complained that neither working men nor farmers were taking any part or interest in the efforts of the Security or Defense Leagues or other movements for national preparedness. The day after Congress declared war, the Socialist Party met in emergency convention in St. Louis and called the declaration a crime against the people in the United States. In the summer of 1917, Socialist anti-war meetings in Minnesota drew large crowds, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 farmers protesting the war, the draft, profiteering. A local newspaper in Wisconsin, the Plymouth Review, said that probably no party ever gained more rapidly in strength than the Socialist Party just at the present time. It reported that thousands assemble to hear socialist speakers in places where ordinarily a few hundred are considered large assemblages. The Akron Beacon Journal, a conservative newspaper in